Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for May the 6th, 2019. This is David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. We have more news and information of interest to veterans and their families, but first I'd like to acknowledge our sponsors, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli, whose financial contribution helps us provide this weekly show for the benefit of veterans, their families, and friends across the country. Also like to remind everyone this is a call-in show, welcomes your views, your comments, your questions. Call us anytime during the show. Grab your pen and paper. Our toll-free call-in number nationwide is 1-888-627-6008. That's 1-888-627-6008. Good evening, Richard.
Hey, David. How are you?
Good.
good evening, everybody. We're starting tonight's show with a variety of news items. From the VA, one major issue affecting veterans who receive their medical care in the VA system involves rules on when the VA will pay for that care in the private sector, what the VA calls community care. The VA recently proposed new rules for veteran community care. That includes six new eligibility criteria for veterans under the VA Mission Act, which was signed into law by Trump in June of 2018. Back to you, David.
Yeah, the background for this goes back to at least 2014 when the Phoenix VA Medical Center scandal broke, where it turned out that some veterans were waiting an extraordinary period of time for care. Some died waiting for care. And then that scandal escalated into a revelation that some VA employees were fudging the wait times. They would make it look like veterans were waiting much shorter periods of time for their care than they actually were. That led to calls for reform. We've had a number of VA secretaries since that time, and in 2018, the latest iteration of efforts by Congress to wrestle with the issue of when can veterans go off into the civilian community, into the private healthcare system, and leave the VA system, but have it paid by the VA. That's what this community care program is about. According to the VA, there are new proposed eligibility criteria. The VA claims it will be a major improvement over existing criteria in terms of making things simpler. Currently, the eligibility criteria vary among various VA community care programs. When the new criteria go into effect, veterans hopefully can expect better access and greater choice in their health care, whether that's at the VA or through a community provider. Over to you, Rick.
Thanks, David. The eligibility criteria are projected to go into effect June 2019 after final regulations are published and effective, so the criteria are not yet final. In addition, key aspects of community care eligibility include the following. Veterans must receive approval from VA prior to obtaining care from a community provider in most circumstances. Veterans must either be enrolled in VA health care or be eligible for VA care without needing to enroll to be eligible for community care. Eligibility for community care will continue to be dependent upon veterans' individual health care needs or circumstances. VA staff members generally make all eligibility determinations. There's your problem right there. Veterans will usually have the option to receive care at a medical facility regardless of their eligibility for community care. And meeting any one of the six eligibility criteria is sufficient to be referred to a community provider. The veteran does not have to meet all of them to be eligible, but remember the VA staff members make all the eligibility determinations. Back to you, David.
Yeah, and the first point you mentioned is really important. I've had many veterans over the last 5 years ask me if they can use what up till now has been called the Veterans Choice Program. They can choose to go into the private sector for care. And a little knowledge is dangerous, and that really applies here too. As you said, Richard, veterans must receive approval from the VA prior to obtaining care from a community provider if they expect the VA to pay for it, which, of course, the veterans usually are. So it's not a matter where they can just decide. Veterans cannot decide on their own that they meet these criteria. But in an effort to so-called simplify the rules on when a veteran can get care, have the VA pay for it, and that care being in the private sector, the proposed rules include six eligibility criteria. And like you said, Richard, a veteran only has to meet one of the six, not all the six. So that there is some good news there. But the first of these, and this is not in any priority, but the first is that veterans need a service that's not available at VA medical facility. That makes sense, that if a veteran needs a specific type of care or particular service and the VA does not provide it in-house, it makes sense the veteran should be able to get that care and have the VA pay for it. The second criteria is that the veteran lives in a U.S. state or territory that does not have a full-service VA medical facility. And most veterans live in states where there are one or more full VA hospitals and numerous clinics. But there are a few states, including Alaska, Hawaii, New Hampshire, and then the U.S. territories of Guam, American Samoa, the Northern Mariana Islands, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, in which there does not exist a full-service VA facility. And in that situation, a veteran living in one of those states or the territories can be eligible. And then the third eligibility criteria is that veterans qualify under what will be considered a grandfather provision related to the distance eligibility for the Veterans Choice Program. You may be wondering, what is that all about? Well, in the last several years, under this so-called Veterans Choice Program, the VA established some access rules, either in terms of how far a veteran was away from a VA hospital how long they had to travel to get to it. And the new proposed rules are as follows, that the veteran's eligible under the 40-mile criterion under the Veterans Choice Program on the day before the VA Mission Act was enacted, which was June 6th, and the veteran continues to reside in a location that would qualify them under that criteria. That's one way to grandfather in under the old Veterans Choice Program. If both of those requirements are met, a veteran may be eligible if one of the following is also true. The veteran lives in one of the five states with the lowest population density from the 2010 census, North or South Dakota, Montana, Alaska, or Wyoming, or the veteran lives in other states, received care between June 6, 2017 and June 6, 2018, and requires care before June 6, 2020. Those are complicated rules. I don't expect any listeners are writing those down, but it just give you a heads up that veterans that have gotten used to the so-called Veterans Choice Program, that it is possible under the new rules, if and when they're implemented, that they may be grandfathered in. Now, there's a fourth of the six criteria that a veteran can meet, and that is if the VA cannot furnish care within certain designated access standards. To be eligible, the veterans must meet specific access standards for average drive time or appointment wait times. And that includes, as far as drive time, a 30-minute average drive time for primary care, mental health, and non-institutional extended care services, or a 60-minute average drive time for specialty care. As far as appointment wait times, 20 days for primary care, mental health care, and non-institutional extended care services, unless the veteran agrees to a later date in consultation with the VA health care provider, or 28 days for specialty care from the date of request, unless the veteran agrees to a later date in consultation with the VA healthcare provider. You're probably shaking your head at the complexity of these rules, but welcome to the VA world. Nothing ever seems to be as simple as it perhaps could be. The fifth of the six criteria is simply that it's in the veteran's best medical interest. Richard, as you say, it ultimately is the VA's determination what that is. The sixth is that a VA medical service line does not meet certain quality standards. So if the VA has identified a service line that's not meeting VA standards for quality based on specific conditions, the veteran can elect to receive care from a community provider within certain limitations. And those details are being fleshed out now. The new criteria are expected to go into effect perhaps as soon as June next month, after the final regulations are published and become effective. But that's just to give veterans kind of a heads up that there are new rules on the way that will replace the old Veterans Choice Program. So if you're a veteran or you're a family member or you know a veteran and they feel like they're waiting a long time to get care in the VA facility, they want to know when can they get care in the private sector or local community at VA expense, be aware new rules are on their way and relatively soon. There is some complexity to that, and as Richard said, ultimately it'll be the VA's decision. So we'll have to see what sort of implementation and what sort of veteran feedback we get from
that. David, there are so many problems with this whole new program. I mean, first of all, as I pointed out, the VA is the final decision maker. So obviously, if I'm sitting home and I'm a veteran, I'm saying, wait a second, if I get denied, what's my alternative? Can I appeal? You know, who do I go to? Do I go to the VA and am I going to get a straight answer from someone at the VA or a DAV or a VSO? I mean, you know, just over the time that, you know, we've been doing veterans, strictly doing veterans law, which is now 7 years, you know, Congress has changed and implemented a lot of new procedures. You know, and I'm not a veteran. I know, David, you're a veteran. I'm not a veteran. And I would be so frustrated to have to constantly get used to a new procedure, new implementation of policy. I mean, you know, who is this really benefiting? At the end of the day, who is really benefiting? And I tell you, what I've seen, I don't see the veteran ever benefiting from any of this crap. Congress might benefit because they're out there tooting their own horn. Look what I'm doing for the veteran, so I can show up at a cocktail party, raise the American flag, and say, "Whoa, look at me, I'm greater than God." But you know something? At the end of the day, you know, it's the veteran that matters. And when we keep putting these roadblocks in front of them, I mean, I deal with veterans every single day. Today, I had 7 interviews in my office. I had another 8 on the phone. That's 15 in less than 6-7 hours today. Every one of them voiced their confusion, their frustration. I'm just one guy handling 15. Imagine across the country what's going on. I mean, it's a mess. Every time I hear more implementation of new guidelines, new procedures, yay, yay, yay. No. Enough's enough. You know, veterans, you guys got to start getting together as a voting bloc and vote these people out of office because they're not thinking of your best interest. They really aren't. I mean, you know, I'm tired of it. And until, you know, some real, you know, we can go back to the Agent Orange issue. We can talk about Camp Lejeune. We can talk about the burn pits. We can talk about a lot of stuff out there. And nothing is being done. Absolutely nothing. It's a bunch of paper-pushing politicians, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, just to toot their own little horn so they can show up in their little counties back home and say, look what I'm doing for you veterans. It's BS is what it is.
I think there's even more frustration that we see on the disability compensation claims appeal system, which we've talked about on many shows over the last 2 years, and the so-called reform, the so-called modernization to speed things up, which we've been predicting, to the extent it speeds it up, will most likely be speeding up the VA denying appeals rather than granting them and shifting more of the burden, more of the work onto the veterans themselves and their representatives rather than the VA and their earlier duty to assist. So, yeah, I think there is a lot of frustration out there, and there's a lot of uncertainty.
David, on that point right there, you know, I'm in touch with a couple of guys over at the VA in St. Pete that are helping me resolve cases. To their credit, they're doing a great job. And each one of these people have said to me, they don't think this new program works to benefit the veteran. And, you know, they've given, they've told me off, you know, confidentially what, how they would handle these cases to try to help veterans. And, you know, it's kind of amazing that, these guys who are supposed to be, you know, the team players for the VA, are, you know, assisting the lawyer for the veteran and telling him, no, don't follow our playbook. There's another playbook that you need to follow out there, and it's not our playbook. So, you know, it's like you said, I mean, the benefit at that VA level when it comes to these claims now is at the VA. I mean, they're trying to push these things off to the federal court. You know, veterans, I don't know, you know, bringing up another topic, because I, in three of my appointments today, I had to tell the veteran that their cases were not in St. Pete, where we initially filed them, that they were in, one was in Boise, one was in North New Jersey, and one was in, I think, Cleveland, Ohio. And their jaw dropped. And they're like, well, do I need to go up there for a hearing? I said, well, we'll cross that bridge when it comes to it. And that's a whole another problem. Here's another one for you, David. I just settled a claim, one you and I have been working on for a very long time. We got the case back in 2014, and I was finally able to settle it. And I got an email from the decision review officer, and he said, well, I can't process the claim yet because I don't have page two of your legal service contract. But I have page one, he says, but I don't have page two. Well, you know, they mentioned this 5 years later. And then I said, well, look, I also want to waive the VA attorney fee process. Will that speed things up? And he says, well I don't allow that.
He says,
I don't allow that. I won't mention his name on the air, but I don't allow that, he says. And I said, well, that's funny, because in St. Pete, that's what we do. He says, well, there's a lot of problems with that St. Pete office, is what he told me. So this is they all work for the same boss.
Right.
They all get paid by the same guy. I mean, come on. You know, you couldn't run a corporation that way. And when he's telling me, well, I don't accept that. Which, and I don't care how we get paid, that's irrelevant. I was trying to speed up the process because the St. Pete people have told me if we waive that attorney fee process, that the veteran will get his retro payment quicker. And we've had cases where the veterans act, you know, they're in hospice, and so we're trying to expedite getting them their money. So when I heard that, I just cracked up. I couldn't believe it. It looks like every day I hear something new about what goes on in the VA that just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
you know, and getting back to some of the things we were discussing earlier about the VA making that determination under this new program, where's the accountability for that decision?
Right, because
is there any accountability?
Usually, healthcare appeals regarding medical care issues are certainly not handled the same way that disability compensation claims are handled. And it's going to rely far more on the VA, you know, the health care side of the VA and their internal reviews on whether these are going to be approved. These meaning the requests by veterans to have the VA pay for their care out in the private sector. So, you know, we've seen this issue now. It really hit the fan in about 2014. We saw the turnover of several VA secretaries all claiming that they were going to have to, you know, address this issue. And several secretaries have come and gone. And then Congress finally passed, you know, they passed the choice legislation to give veterans a choice under certain limited situations. But there were problems. We were getting feedback that from some veterans and hearing about others that had problems. The VA wasn't processing those requests in a timely manner. So it kind of defeats the whole purpose. And now then Congress passed this major piece of legislation a year ago that now, just now, a year later, the VA has developed some criteria for when this private sector medical care can be done. But it's a really big issue, particularly among some veteran groups who, you'll hear the debate even between veteran groups, some which strongly oppose any attempt or even appearance of the VA veterans care being privatized on the one hand, and then you have a few groups that are pushing that under the guise of more choice for veterans, but then you have to be suspicious. Are they just trying to benefit the private sector? Do they have some other axe to grind with the VA itself and the bureaucracy, which they obviously oppose? But anyway, it is, what's interesting in the corresponding debate that we hear in the political arena about government-run health care and the government taking over the whole health care system and pushing the insurance companies out of the picture. Certainly there's a lot of room for improvement there. But I've heard a few people point to the VA system as a standard, and yet we see what the VA system can do, its strengths and weaknesses. A lot of veterans are very happy with the care they get in the VA system. Many of them are, but there are some that aren't. And certainly it's clear from history, including the last 5 years, that the VA doesn't have all the resources. As we've mentioned on many shows in the past, the VA healthcare side is understaffed by their own numbers at the tune of about 40,000 healthcare people. And so there is the need there. And we've had veterans on our show in the past that have talked about difficulties in getting care for treatment of PTSD and other things. So that's a big issue. And it just shows when you're establishing rules and criteria, things quickly get very complicated. In our system, a lot of room for maybe some new ideas. But in any event, Rick, I see you have some other news this week from the VA.
Yeah, in the celebration of National Women's Health Week, May 12th through the 18th, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs medical centers across the country will host events to support women veterans and connect them with the VA's healthcare services. VA is serving nearly 500,000 women's veterans, and we want to take care of even more, said VA Secretary Robert Wilkie. Events like these get them through the doors so they meet VA health providers and learn firsthand about the comprehensive services and quality care VA provides to women who have served. Women are among the fastest-growing veteran demographics, accounting for more than 30% of the increase in veterans who served between 2014 and 2018. The number of women using VA services has tripled since 2000, growing from about 160,000 to nearly 500,000 today. The VA offers a wide range of primary care and specialty services for women. Veterans such as health screenings, preconception counseling, maternity care, menopause support, and more. VA medical centers with dedicated women's health clinics will celebrate National Women's Health Week by hosting either an open house or outreach events. Veterans attending these events can speak with healthcare providers about broad range of services offered at their medical centers and hear from experts on topics such as maternity care and child safe home. Tours of these clinics and education materials will be available. VA is seeking broad public participation and encourages veteran service organization members to participate. News media are welcome to cover these events. To learn about events at facilities and communities around the country, visit the local VAMC website or contact the public affairs officer directly. VA encourages women veterans not currently using VA health care services to enroll and use the benefits they have earned. Call the Women Veteran Call Center for information at 1-855-VA-WOMEN. That's 855-829-6636 for information or visit womenshealth.va.gov. Again, that's womenshealth.va.gov. You know, David, one of the things that I hope that they do in that regard is focus on women who are victims of military sexual trauma.
Yes.
I know a lot of the women that we do represent who are struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, many of them, if not most of them, that I've been dealing with have been victims of military sexual trauma. And the feedback that I'm getting is that the VA is very poor in this regard. They really don't provide the support groups that a lot of these women say that they need. A lot of the women walk away from them because the attitude amongst a lot of the VA staffing members is kind of like, well, you put yourself in that situation. I've heard that many times, which is pretty absurd. I hope they do address that, because so far I haven't seen that in our news-related promo here. In related news, the VA added a text messaging feature to the Women Veterans Call Center on April 23rd, providing another convenient way for women to seek information about VA benefits, health care, and available resources. Women veterans can now text 855-829-6636 to receive answers and guidance about VA services. I hope women take advantage of that. Again, that number is 855-829-6636. That could prove to be very beneficial. We want to make it as easy as possible for women veterans to get answers about eligibility requirements, benefit services, and more, said Robert Wilkie. By offering new methods of communication, such as texting, we can reach more women veterans and support their health care needs more quickly. This must be a Trump idea, Mr. Texter himself. Putting into the VA program. The Women Veterans Call Center is staffed by trained, compassionate female VA employees who can provide and link callers to available resources such as health care, benefits, and cemetery information via phone, chat, and now text. The new texting feature aligns this service with other VA call centers that provide information assistance to veterans who are in crisis at risk for suicide and becoming homeless. VA works to meet the unique requirements for women while offering privacy, dignity, and sensitivity to gender-specific needs. Since April 2013, the call center has received nearly 83,000 inbound calls and has initiated almost 1.3 million outbound calls. As the number of women veterans continues to grow, the VA is expanding its outreach to ensure they receive enrollment and benefit information through means that are user-friendly and responsive. Again, for more information about Women's Veterans Call Center, visit www.womenshealth.va.gov/. David, one thing that I'm kind of intrigued about is how does the VA handle transgender veterans?
I don't have the strongest idea.
Yeah, I don't either. And I wonder if they're going to have their own texting line themselves.
Well, in other news, as we reported in early February, and a major development for Navy veterans who served on ships off the coast of Vietnam during the Vietnam War, a federal appeals court decided on Tuesday, January the 29th of this year, that the Department of Veterans Affairs cannot deny disability benefits to thousands of Vietnam veterans who claim exposure to cancer-causing chemical defoliants simply because those vets served in the waters off the country's coastline and not inland. That decision in the case of Procopio versus Wilkie marks a big victory for the so-called Blue Water Navy veterans who have fought the VA for years over the denials of their Agent Orange disability compensation claims. VA officials have asserted that the existing scientific evidence doesn't justify the presumption of toxic exposure for that group of veterans and have strongly opposed legislative efforts to overturn the decision. But the 9-2 decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit on January the 29th, overturned past court opinions which had supported the VA. The decision basically held that Congress never intended to exclude service members in the seas around Vietnam when they awarded presumptive benefits for certain illnesses related to Agent Orange exposure. The appeals court said in part, and I quote, "These statutes cast no doubt on our conclusion that by using the formal term Republic of Vietnam, Congress unambiguously referred, consistent with uniform international law, to both its landmass and its 12 nautical mile territorial sea." So since the decision, the VA is in the process of trying to implement this. But meanwhile, congressional efforts have still continued, being pushed by some veteran groups that are trying to make sure that that the VA doesn't somehow try to dodge the effects of this decision by the appellate court, and also try to protect Navy veterans who might have served further out at sea beyond the 12 nautical mile territorial sea limit. So it's an ongoing issue, but as we reported earlier, the January decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is a major win for Vietnam veterans that served in Navy ships off the coast of Vietnam. Over to you, Rick.
Yeah, on that note, it is a major win, but I filed my third Form 9 appeal of the statement of the case for a Blue Water veteran. And basically, when dealing with the VA decision review officers, they basically said, "We don't, quote unquote, we don't know how to handle these cases. We don't know what to do with them. So you're better off letting me issue a statement of the case and let the federal court, let the BPA handle it," which is basically what they did. I mean, I tried to persuade them otherwise, but again, it's their determination. So they determined that at this particular time, you know, they're going to still deny it, and I can take it up with the BVA. So
I would think that some of those cases are going to involve veterans that were serving on ships that were further out at sea, because this particular decision, the basis for ruling in favor of the veterans was that the Agent Orange statutes passed by Congress referred to the Republic of Vietnam, and the court said that the court believed Congress was very clear in its intent that by using the formal term Republic of Vietnam, that Congress intended that to include the territorial sea limits out to 12 nautical miles. Well, who knows whether Congress really intended that? You know, based on past experience and reading what Congress does and doesn't do, I'd venture to say that probably a lot of members that signed on that for that legislation probably never even read it carefully, and certainly didn't analyze whether the term Republic of Vietnam meant just the land or also extended out 12 miles, nautical miles off the coast. But in any event, there are a lot of Navy veterans that served in some of the ships, the carriers, et cetera, that served far beyond 12 miles. They might have been 75 or 100 miles off the coast. And this court decision, unfortunately, doesn't help them. That's why there are some veteran groups, like Military Veterans Advocacy, that is pushing for legislation that will protect that larger group of veterans. What happens with that legislation is yet unknown. We'll have to see how that works out. But we do know from past experience that the VA bureaucracy has really opposed extending it, and now this court decision is really forcing on the VA to recognize ships that were released within that 12 nautical mile limit. And then the question is, which ships were in that limit? And that's where you get into having to research, you know, the deck logs to show where the ships were. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, going back and checking with the National Archives to get the deck logs for these ships. The VA is supposed to be doing these things, but whether they are, whether they're doing it fast enough is really going to be the problem. So,
The other problem, though, is before you even get to that part of it, is the decision review officers that I've been dealing with, and we, in two of the cases, we confirmed that the ship was within the 12 nautical miles. So technically, it falls under the umbrella of this decision. The problem is that the VA are telling me we have not been given guidance as to how to handle these cases. We haven't been trained. We haven't seen anything other than the fact that there's this decision out there. And when I ask them, well, when do you expect, you know, to get some sort of training? One basically said no idea. Another one said 6 to 9 months. So I said, "What? So until then, you're just going to deny them?" And I said, "Yeah, because we got to move these cases off our desk, Mr. Hurley. I've got a supervisor that's telling me you got to move these cases."
Well, it gets them off their desk, and it basically punts it to the Board of Veterans Appeals, which is
something we've heard many times.
Well, that's what we've seen historically for
right.
years, for decades, with the regional office, that all the folks there do is basically look at the internal VA operating manuals on how to process claims. And it takes a long time for things like a federal appellate court decision to get implemented in their operating manual. So meanwhile, they do exactly what they've been doing in the past, which is they just punt. They say, the regional offices are not very good at looking at what the federal appellate courts have done or even their own Board of Veterans Appeals. So they're just going to punt it to the BVA, which means the veteran gets to wait who knows how much longer, years, before the appeals reform legislation, they might wait 3, 4, 5 years once a case leaves the regional office and goes to the Board of Veterans Appeals. Hopefully, under this new legislation, it'll be faster, but what does faster mean? 1 or 2 years versus 4 or 5 years or 3 or 4 years? Who knows? That's all unknown. We're just going to have to see how things play out, But in any event, it's a big issue, and, meanwhile, these Vietnam veterans are they're not getting any younger. These guys are,
We just, David, as you know, David, we just buried one of our clients 10 days ago. Actually, 10 days ago. And fortunately, or unfortunately, it depends on how you want to look at it, he got his retro payment about 8 days before he died. And, he'd been fighting for years, like most veterans. And he was a Vietnam vet. So they just keep dying off, and it's like one of the doctors that I've dealt with said to me that one of the reasons he's no longer working at the VA is because he was told years ago that when they asked this doctor about what it would cost the VA on certain implementation things, and he gave a number like $10 billion. And they said, "Well, if we wait 5 years, what would it cost?" And he said, "Well, $3 to $5 billion. Well, if we wait another 5 years, well, probably under $1 billion. And so the VA told the doctor, "Well, wait the 10 years then, so it doesn't cost us as much money."
Yeah.
So they kind of did that with the Blue Water people. They were all out there, and now probably I don't know how many, but a lot of them are dead that aren't going to benefit from the new legislation. In more news from Washington, the VA announced on April 29th that the VA and Cigna, a global health service company, recently developed a new public-private partnership to improve safety and quality of care for veterans with chronic pain who are at risk for opioid misuse. The partnership, which was formalized March 7th, will educate veterans and their families, the public and health care providers, about the following: safe opioid use, improving provider and patient interactions related to opioid use, and helping to improve delivery of care and health outcomes for veterans. This partnership is in line with the VA's priorities of transforming our business systems and supporting more robust partnerships with state and local communities, said Secretary Robert Wilkie. By partnering with Cigna, we have extended our reach to help improve the way healthcare providers approach opioid use, and will demonstrate our commitment to place veteran safety and well-being above all. David M. Cordani, President and CEO of Cigna, agreed. Public-private partnerships are critical to address the opioid epidemic in the U.S., Cordani said. It's an honor and a privilege to partner with the VA to support the brave men and women who serve in the United States Armed Forces. We look forward to sharing our resources and best practices to benefit veterans and the communities that support them. VA's opioid safety initiative has reduced the number of veterans prescribed an opioid by more than 50% over the past 6 years, with more than 75% of those reductions attributed to not starting patients newly on long-term opioid therapy. VA is managing pain more effectively by using multiple strategies and alternative therapies such as yoga, meditation, and acupuncture. The VA healthcare providers also participate in state prescription drug monitoring programs and training to manage the opioid crisis. Through the partnership, VA and Cigna will also promote existing supportive resources such as the Veterans Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and Cigna's Veterans Support Line at 855-244-6211. Well, this, David, is really good news. We've reported this in the past. It's nice to see the VA is addressing a national crisis and a veterans crisis with the opioid use, and using such things as yoga, meditation, acupuncture are great starts. Who knows, maybe even the CBD and marijuana will come into play, too. I know some veterans who, on their own, they're using it and telling me that it definitely helps them deal with their PTSD. So it's good to see that they're moving in that direction. Back to you.
Yeah, the opioid crisis really is just that, a crisis. Some quick facts on that. Between 1999 and 2017, almost 400,000 people died from an overdose involving an opioid, and about 68% of the more than 70,200 drug overdose deaths in 2017 involved an opioid. On average, 130 Americans die every day for an opioid overdose. So it's a big problem. Goes far beyond the veteran community. In other veteran news from the state of Florida, which has the third largest number of veterans in the United States, the state veterans organization has a program to help companies hire veterans. We all know that hiring and training a skilled workforce can be time-consuming and expensive. If you want to stay competitive in this modern economy, you need to find the right people for your team. Identifying and attracting that talent is necessary, but not always easy. You can build your bottom line by partnering with the Veterans Florida Employer Services. They have an excellent website. It's easy to remember. Go to veteransflorida.org/employers. They offer a number of incentives in their workforce training grant. That includes up to $8,000 in this grant program for every new veteran that's hired and trained. Also, veteran employee candidate recruiting and screening to supplement a company's existing recruiting efforts tailored to meet the company's needs. Free access to a pool of highly qualified candidates and other financial incentives and benefits available to businesses in Florida who hire veterans. So, they're open for business. If you're an employer in the state of Florida and you want to know how you can find out more about partnering with the Veterans Florida organization, go to the website, which is veteransflorida.org/employers. There's no obligation when registering with this program. The program is interested in working with you and your business and your workforce needs. So check that out, veteransflorida.org/employers. Over to you, Rick.
Hey, David, why don't you fill us in on the latest on our documentary?
Yeah, great. Our Stop War Today program, the website is stopwar.today. We finished in mid-April filming for what will be our first film, as well as short film and trailer for that. And it's at the editors right now, and we're looking for that to be finished either the last week of May, the first week of June. So coming up pretty quickly, and I'm very optimistic about this, and it will be the foundation for future films. We will be using this to kind of kick off a larger project in an effort to educate people and government officials about really the full spectrum of the costs of war on every level, as well as to provide information and insight about how we can promote a mindset that places peace building over militarism, that explores peaceful ways to resolve international conflict. We're going to be highlighting the research and the work of Brown University's Cost of War Project, Their website is costsofwar.org. Also, the United States Institute of Peace, which the website is usip.org, as well as an excellent book called A Mighty Case Against War by author Kathy Beckwith of Oregon. Those are just some of the resources we're going to be promoting and publicizing. Certainly not the only ones. It's not our intention to reinvent the wheel. There are so many great individuals and organizations out there doing work to help in this area, and we just want to add our voice to it and help present that in a way that hopefully will receive a wider audience and have an impact. You and I know, Richard, that when we started talking about this project, just in our own informal conversations with people and with groups, we found that hardly anyone that we've met and talked to have ever even heard of the United States Institute of Peace, which is a congressionally created nonpartisan, nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C., and you and I attended a conference there last October. Most Americans have never even heard about it, and its mission, you know, created by Congress, is basically twofold: to be both a think tank to promote peaceful resolution of conflict, but also to be active out in the world by sending trainers and mediators and researchers out into countries to study the causes of conflict, but also to serve as mediators to help mediate conflict. So there's a lot of good work being done out there, and part of our project is simply to help spread the word about that. What do you think, Rick?
Well, no, that's, you know, you kind of said it all. I mean, it's mind-boggling when you start thinking about the cost of war. And, you know, people don't realize when, you know, I was just talking to some family members over the weekend. When you tell them what the current state of the United States in war, and the fact that we are currently in the longest war that this country's ever been in, the fact that we, you know, for the first time in the history of this country, we are borrowing money to pay for this war, and then you start bringing up all these other facts to you know, family members and friends and this informal conversation, and they really just have no idea, you know. I mean, and these are their tax dollars at work, and they're just clueless, and I don't know I don't know why there's so much apathy in terms of, you know, being interested in this topic. Maybe, you know, they're all doing well, and, you know, we keep hearing how great the economy is and all that kind of stuff. And maybe they're just happy with the way things are, and they don't want to upset the apple cart. But bottom line is, down the road, you know, many, many years to come, and it's going to be sooner than later, and it's going to be my children, my grandchildren. But they're the ones who are going to be paying for this period in our lives right now. They're the ones who are going to be paying for these expenditures, the credit card that we've used to finance all these wars. And it's nonsense. And hopefully with this film, you know, David, you know, we start getting the discussion across the aisle, the discussion at the dinner table, the discussion in school systems, you know, amongst like-minded people, you know, different people, different backgrounds. But everyone needs to get into the discussion, because, you know, the bottom line is, you know, it cannot, sooner or later the dam's going to burst. And when it bursts, who knows what the consequences are going to be. I think we can all agree the consequences are not going to be good, because it's going to be extremely costly.
And we also see in the daily news how quickly kind of a mindset of turning to the military could quickly get out of hand. Just the events of the last day or two, where, you know, there's been more warfare in the Middle East and involving Israel, but also where there are allegations that Iran has plotted to attack U.S. assets in that region, and that intel was allegedly passed on to us from Israel, and now we're sending a carrier to that region. You know, you can see how things can get out of hand very quickly. And, you know, if you look at the history of American wars over the last 60 years, we've had two major wars, the Vietnam War and the 2003 Iraq invasion, that were both instigated and escalated based on faulty intelligence. So, you know, anytime I start seeing in the news about intelligence reports this or that, I have a very skeptical eye about that. But then the other part, the bigger part is, why are we so quick just to send in the military? You know, things are far more complex than what the media reports. So the media has a lot of blood on its hands in this whole thing. But that's why part of our project, as you know, Rick, is a multimedia project to kind of a paradigm shift in thinking. And in Kathy Beckwith's book, and I'll offer free copies to anyone that wants one. Send me an email. My email address is lawcorey1@verizon.net. That's LAWCORY, the number 1, at verizon.net. Send me an email. I will send you a free copy of her book, A Mighty Case Against War. It really is an outstanding book. It's written for a general audience, but it's suitable for college students, high school students, in terms of its depth of research. It took her 7 years to put this book together with research.
You know,
go ahead.
What's great about that book, David, is you know, you can put that book by your bedstand. You know, you can put it by your John if you want to, if you enjoy reading on the John. And you can read, you know, a half a dozen pages just on one section, because she really breaks it up. So it's not something you have to sit down and think that you got to read it like a novel from cover to cover. I mean, it's very easy reading. So, you know, it's kind of a person's guide to war and why we should reconsider war.
In my humble opinion, it's the kind of book that ought to be read in every high school history or American civics class, as well as every college, at least American history class, because she goes through and analyzes Americans' wars and looks at it from both sides. But she has several chapters on, okay, what are the alternatives? And her background is in mediation. I know yours, you have extensive background in mediation too, Rick. And but this is really making mediation an effective tool and on the international arena. Instead of making military the first option, make it truly the last option. It's a great book. It really is. It's called A Mighty Case Against War. You can find it through Dignity Press, but also through Amazon. But you can also get a free copy from me if you send me an email. So, okay, well, we'll keep our audience updated. But meanwhile, you can go to our project website, which is stopwar.today. And hopefully in a little more than a month, we'll have our first film out there. And we're going to use it to kind of kick off the start of more films and obviously the fundraising that we need to go along with that. So if anyone's interested in supporting us financially and the filming and all that, we welcome that too. So, okay, we're about running out of time. Rick, you want to bring it home with our Coaching Into Care reminder?
Yeah, that's great. A great way to close the show. We do this every week. It's an important part of the show. And, you know, just want to remind veterans and their families about the program called Coaching Into Care. This program helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment and loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call. The number is 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the VA's Coaching Into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal, or in a crisis of any time, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs also has a Veterans Crisis Line. You can call that number at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. That number is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Check us out, David.
Okay, it's time for us to go. I'd like to thank each of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on the great BBS Radio Station 1. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli and Corey and Hurley Law Group. I'd like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. And we hope you'll tune in next week. Same time, same station. We have an excellent guest next week, a psychiatrist, a lot of expertise in post-traumatic stress, and has written about that. We'll be here same time, same station for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. We'll look forward to having you then. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.